Okay, good afternoon. Sorry for the delay. We had some technical issues, but we're all here now. So thank you very much for coming this afternoon. My name is Sarah Ladislaw. I'm the Director of the Energy and National Security Program here at CSIS. And I'm really pleased to be here today with two of the colleagues on the stage from the Rhodium Group. But we also have several of their other colleagues in the room who've been helping out with the report as well. I'm very pleased to have everyone here today to talk about a new report that we've just finished sort of the first round of called Remaking American Power, which takes a look at the energy sector impacts of the Clean Power Plan. And so just by way of background, I'm going to talk a little bit about why we are doing what we're doing and what stage in the process we're at, why we think it's important, why we decided to partner with Rhodium, and why they decided to partner with us is anybody's guess, and then where we will be going this fall. So for those of you who are CSIS Energy Program regulars, and I see a lot of you in the audience, a lot of what we've been doing over the last several years is looking at how oil and gas production in the U.S. and the production surge in the U.S. has been changing things fairly materially, both for the United States in terms of an energy market, energy policy, energy technology perspective, but also for us geopolitically as well. And the Rhodium Group, and Trevor, a principal at the Rhodium Group, and John Larson, both in your World Resource Institute past, but also at the Department of Energy and now with the Rhodium Group, have long been looking at sort of decarbonization policies, especially in the electric power sector, and how to sort of model and understand those impacts. And so we thought that that set of skills, when matched together, actually allowed us to get at something that we think is actually a really important issue, which is in the face of what has been a very dynamic energy sector in the United States over the last 5 years, in particular, when you add a policy into the electric power sector that is looking to reduce emissions, what kind of impacts does that have not only on sort of larger economic impacts for the country, but also in terms of what are the impacts both on the national level in terms of the fuel mix, energy, natural gas production, coal production, but then how those things play out on a regional level as well. And so where we are today is we've come up with preliminary findings, and we call them preliminary findings because they look at a subset of what we're going to look at, which is mostly some of the national level impacts, both in terms of what it does to the energy sector, but also what we tried to do was bound how we were looking at it by design features that states have as options for dealing with this new rule, and bound them in a way that we think is interesting for trying to derive some of those conclusions for what's happening in the kind of impacts that you would see in the energy sector. And so that's what we're going to present today is some of those sort of national level impacts. We will have a bit of a teaser at the end about what this could mean on a regional level and why we think that's important. I just want to say, you know, the Clean Power Plan and the rule itself is a highly politicized issue, right? It has a lot of uncertainties, and we'll talk a little bit about the ones that we expressly don't address, and all of the sort of normative or design feature issues that we don't seek to address. We also are very aware that we're probably one of 12 to 15 studies that are going to be looking at different parts of the impacts of this rule or different potential rules as it might sort of come out in the end, different challenges that people present or the way the EPA thinks about some of the challenges in the draft that they've put forward. But we're not going to deal with a lot of those, right? So we don't deal with reliability issues. We don't deal with, you know, estimating benefits and sort of the, we do estimate benefits, but we don't get into sort of the, you know, the art and the science behind that. We really are trying to add value on the decisions that states and regions and, in fact, sort of national level policymakers have to take into account when they're trying to think about the best possible economic outcomes of implementation of this kind of a policy. So I'm going to leave it there. I'm going to turn it over to Trevor, who will do some more introductory comments. We'll go through the presentation and then hope to have a bit of a discussion. So, Trevor.
Great. Thanks, Sarah. And thanks, everybody, for turning out today. The why partner with CSIS is an obvious answer that it's, I think there is no shop that has done more to provide objective, fact-based analysis and insight on energy market and policy dynamics in DC than CSIS, and then Sarah and her team in particular. And so, you know, coming into this study, our intuition was that understanding the impact of the Clean Power Plan, the potential impact in the electric power sector itself, required understanding the broader energy market context in which it's going to be implemented, but also that the Clean Power Plan will not just impact the electric power sector, it will impact other parts of the energy market, and it was important to take that into account, as Sarah said. And I think, as you'll see in the results that we're presenting today, why that approach is important and the kind of benefit of this partnership, which was also just a pure joy. The real brains behind this operation on the RHG side are both my colleague John Larson and then Shashank Mahan, Whitney Ketchum, who are sitting in the front row here. I'm just their puppet mouthpiece, and I will, in very short order, turn it over to John for a real insight and intuition. Can we go to the, we have a clicker here. Excellent. The EPA proposal, for those who have not read the 800-page Federal Register entry themselves, though it's a real bodice ripper, and I encourage you all to go check it out. Then we'll go over the kind of scope and methodology of this particular study, walk through five key findings from the analysis that we've done to date, and then tee up what we're going to be looking at over the next couple of months for a full report to be published in October. And part of the, what we're hoping from this session here is to get your reaction in the Q&A to what we're presenting now and insights. As Sarah said, the kind of universe of possibilities to analyze with the Clean Power Plan is vast. And so in our narrowing down process, getting a sense of what's going to be most important and informative as stakeholders try to navigate this process in the months ahead.
Thanks, Trevor. So quick overview of the EPA Clean Power Plan, 800 pages in two slides. First, we're going to just start with process. Right now, we're in the design phase of the Clean Power Plan. It was proposed in June. The comment period ends in October, mid-October, and as we move forward, EPA is expected to finalize the plan in June of 2015. After that, we're going into the implementation phase. This is where states have to make, have to construct their own implementation plans and get them approved by EPA. That process could take as little, it's supposed to take as little as a year, but could go as far as into 2018. And then finally, 2020 is when the compliance period starts. And from 2020 all the way through 2030 and beyond, the Clean Power Plan has emission rate goals that each state is going to have to meet. And when you consider those emission rate goals, it's basically a pounds per megawatt hour emissions rate averaged over the entire fossil fleet in a state. That's the goal that needs to be met. States can submit their own individual state plan or cooperate with other states. We think that's actually very important. We'll talk a lot more about how we see that playing out in the energy markets. And it's important to remember that states can implement virtually any program or policy they want, so long as they can demonstrate it's going to meet the goals and that those standards are enforceable. So it's actually very unclear how this will really play out. We probably won't know for sure until more like 2019, but we can still get a better understanding today. And EPA set its goals using four building blocks. One is heat rate improvements at coal plants. Another is displacing or fuel switching from coal to natural gas. Third is fuel switching away from fossil fuels towards zero-emitting generation. And then finally, demand-side energy efficiency. So with that, great. Back to you, Trevor.
So like we said at the start, our goal was not primarily to provide new insights into what this would mean for the electric power sector per se, but for energy markets more broadly. And so to do that, we use the National Energy Modeling System used by EIA for the annual energy outlook because it combines both detailed representation of the U.S. power sector and broader modeling of the energy market. So from oil and gas production to coal production to downstream impacts in residential and commercial buildings. And the results from that analysis we present at a national, at a regional, and at a sectoral level, some of which we'll present today and the rest of which will be presented in the full report in October. As was already mentioned several times, the ultimate impact of this proposal will depend on the state implementation plans that are developed over the next several years. And so rather than being predictive about how states will develop those plans, what we're trying to do with this analysis is assess the impact of an economically efficient, economically optimal way of implementing those plans, testing out two major design variables. The first is the extent to which states cooperate in both developing and implementing their plans. EPA has allowed for states to submit implementation plans jointly and comply as a block rather than as individual states. So you can imagine, for example, the New England states that are part of REGI, which is a cap and trade program that covers a number of Northeast states, submitting a plan together. That's a possibility. So we bookend outcomes. We look at a scenario where you have cooperation between all 50 states to set one goalpost, and a scenario where each state, although, as I'll point out in a second, in our modeling, that's done by power market region, which is slightly larger than a state, has to comply individually to highlight how that impacts the energy market results and the costs as states consider whether or not to try to cooperate in meeting these targets or not. And then the second major design variable is the extent to which states include energy efficiency crediting as a compliance mechanism. EPA has allowed for that. In the building blocks that that John mentioned, EPA includes energy efficiency potential as one building block. That doesn't necessarily mean that states need to credit energy efficiency as a compliance pathway, but they're provided with that option. So again, to bookend, we look at one scenario where no energy efficiency crediting occurs, and another where all states credit energy efficiency at the levels that EPA outline in their building blocks. For the national cooperation versus regional fragmentation bookends, we are looking at power markets, the 22 power markets in the U.S., and in the national cooperation case, set a single emission rate target for all states, assuming that there will be interstate credit trading, and in the regional case, each region has it has the emission rate target specifically defined by EPA. And then in scenarios where we explore crediting energy efficiency, we use EPA's efficiency cost estimates and impact estimates directly. So just to walk through what we're going to show today and then what's going to be presented in October. So those we have three scenarios, national cooperation with EE, national cooperation without EE, and regional fragmentation with energy efficiency. There will be three additional scenarios, policy design scenarios included in the report in October. Also in October, we're going to explore how different developments in the energy market could impact those results. So both if shale gas resources, which as you'll see in a minute is an important variable, prove to be higher than currently projected or lower than currently projected, if export demand for natural gas in the form of LNG is higher than currently committed or lower than currently committed. And in terms of results, we're showing results from those scenarios in terms of energy prices, energy expenditures. We're looking at compliance costs and benefits. And then looking upstream at changes in natural gas production, prices and revenue, and coal production prices and revenue. And we'll walk through those today. There are a number of developments that could occur between now and when state implementation plans actually take effect that could make their impact different than what we're modeling here today. EPA could modify its proposal between now and when the final rule is issued next summer. You could have legal challenges that delay or change elements of the rule. And then there's also differences in how energy prices, energy demand develop that could be beyond the scenarios that we include in our sensitivity and would obviously lead to different results. So again, this is not to be predictive of how states will comply and what the impact will be, but to show the range of possibilities. All right. So to get us started on the key findings, the first key finding from this analysis is that the shale boom of the past few years makes compliance with either the Clean Power Plan or other emission reductions policies relatively affordable compared to before the shale boom occurred. So a little bit of background, the growth in shale resources over the past decade and the reduction in natural gas prices in the U.S. as a result have lowered the cost of natural gas-fired power generation relative to coal-fired power generation, which is the slide that you see on the left. And that change in relative prices has led to a significant change in generation mix. So as natural gas-fired generation has gotten cheaper, more of it has dispatched. As relative coal generation has gotten relatively more expensive, less of it is dispatched, to a point where in April 2012, natural gas produced as much electricity in the U.S. as coal for the first time ever. Since 2012, we've actually seen a rise in U.S. natural gas prices, which further underscores the sensitivity of power sector outcomes to changes in fuel costs. As natural gas prices have risen over the past year, year and a half, coal has regained market share in the U.S. That switch from 2007 to 2012 in generation from natural gas, from coal to natural gas, helped contribute to a fairly substantial reduction in power sector CO2 emissions over that time period, alongside the recession, improvements in energy efficiency, and an acceleration in the deployment of renewable energy. Importantly, though, as that switch has reversed, and as coal has regained market share in the U.S., CO2 emissions in the U.S. have risen. Total CO2 emissions increased in 2013. And under current policy, the EIA projects that power sector emissions will stay either flat or increase modestly in the years ahead. So low-cost gas helped deliver significant emission reductions, but we've picked about as much of that low-hanging fruit as we can. It is unlikely that we're going to see additional power sector emission reductions just because of low-cost gas. However, that gas changes the cost and the dynamics of policy aimed at reducing emissions, as we see in our results analyzing the Clean Power Plan.
And so, our first results slide on the left is our reference case generation mix going out from 2010 to 2030. And the two lower areas, red and orange, are coal and gas, and they largely follow the emissions chart that Trevor just showed. And coal generation stays about flat into the future, whereas gas rises to meet overall demand. When you add in a emissions performance standard, such as what's contemplated in the Clean Power Plan, you change the incentives for generators in the marketplace and can take further advantage of some of the, and we see that it takes further advantage of some of the low-cost shale gas resources available. So what happens is you have an emissions rate standard. Any generator with an emissions rate above that standard incurs a penalty and has a reason to run less in the market because it has a higher cost. Meanwhile, any generator below that emission standard, mostly low carbon generators like natural gas, combined cycle, and renewables, have an incentive to run more. And that is how you meet the emissions rate, but it also changes the overall market dynamics in a way that shifts generation. You can see on the right-hand side, this is one of our scenarios, the national case without EE, that shows that generation from natural gas increases substantially while coal generation goes down. This is shows you the most cost-effective outcome to meeting an emissions rate standard solely through generation mitigation options. That generation shift due to the switch in incentives, it's largely met through increased generation at existing gas plants. So on the reference, our reference case on the left-hand side shows you additions of capacity into the future with mostly natural gas and renewables projected to meet demand into the future with no policy. And again, you know, existing gas runs more to meet the emissions rate standard, but new gas also comes in to help get you to the finish line. And you can see a substantial increase in natural gas capacity additions into the future relative to 2010 in this chart. And then meanwhile, you see the same shifts in incentives force more coal to the sidelines, and more coal capacity gets retired under the policy case. Again, this is one of our cases. We're going to show you how that outcome changes as we consider different design elements. So when you have that shift in incentives in generation and changes in capacity, you see fairly big emission reductions. And the green line here is our national case with just the generation side options considered. And you can see emissions go down substantially out into the future. even lower than the EPA's own projections of the Clean Power Plan. Big reason for that is something that I think gets lost when we think about emissions rate standards. They do not predetermine an emissions outcome. They are dynamic, and the outcome is sensitive to market dynamics and policy design. And so, you know, different market dynamics around shale gas, for example, or any technology costs for renewables could change your emissions outcome when you meet the same emissions rate standard. So that's important to note, and that's a big reason why our green line is lower than the red line in this particular scenario. So moving on to costs, on the left-hand side, you can see that this big emission reduction from the shifts in generation incentives actually achieves big gains with relatively small impacts on electric rates, about 4%. In this case, we see the rates go as high as almost 10% nationally in other cases, which I'll cover later. That is within the same area and range of what EPA's rate impacts are projected to be. Just for reference, when EPA did an analysis of Waxman-Markey, they projected something closer to 14% or 13 or 14% rate impact. So, you know, we're just to give people kind of orientation to what this means. Waxman-Markey is a very different policy, but the Clean Power Plan and the Clean Power Plan achieves less reductions, so you have other reasons for that difference. On the right-hand side, the costs of the policy are not zero. They are about $12 billion in our national generation side case, but they are still relatively modest in the big picture. And when you we use EPA's methodology to consider not just to consider the benefits in the form of public health benefits and avoided climate damages, and we see fairly large benefits in large part because we see a lot of emission reductions. So another key finding is that when you include energy efficiency, it reduces both costs and benefits of the policy. So this is change in generation relative to reference, and on the left-hand side is our national without EE case, where you're just meeting the standard through generation side options. And on the right-hand side, you're seeing the same national cooperation, but now we've added in energy efficiency crediting. And you can see a couple of things. First off, on the generation side only case on the left, you see that same coal to gas switch we talked about previously. That is the most cost-effective pathway to meeting the standard, given current expectations on gas prices and technology costs for renewables. When you add in EE, you see, because you're now reducing demand from energy efficiency, you have a lower amount of shift between coal and gas. But you still have a shift between coal and gas. In fact, that's still the primary way you get to the standard after energy efficiency is considered. Just the magnitude of that change is much smaller than when you take EE out of the equation. That also means a difference in emission reductions. Again, I mentioned before, power emissions rate standards don't predetermine your emissions reduction outcome. And this is another good example of that. On the left-hand side, without EE, we have higher emission abatement than we have with EE. Part of that is the policy design and market dynamics I talked about. The other thing is, when you open the door to crediting EE, you do bring in the option of crediting energy savings that states were going to pursue anyway. That means you may not get as much emission reductions as you anticipated because you're crediting actions that were already effectively in the reference case. We do account for that in this analysis to some degree, and you can see that's another reason why these numbers are different. And you know, when you have different impacts on the generation and abatement side, you should expect different costs. So on the left-hand side here, again, is electric rates. They move up modestly compared to the national without EE case. This is because EE isn't free. You have to pay for it. That comes at a cost. That gets rolled into electric rates, so rates go up. But when you achieve real energy savings from those investments, your overall electric bills go down. And you can see electric expenditures go down by a little over 2% relative to reference case in our with EE scenario, and overall energy expenditures also go down relative to reference case. In the meantime, your costs could potentially be higher. There's a lot of variation on the debate about how the cost of EE should be accounted for. We present a low and a high end range here. It's quite a big range of how things could play out. But on the high end, you could actually see higher compliance costs to meet the emissions rate standard by including EE. But you do get this consumer benefit from lower energy bills. Key finding three, cooperation lowers costs. This is a bit intuitive, but it's important to put some numbers around it. So this is the same idea about the change in electric power generation relative to reference, but this time we're looking at the difference between national cooperation and regional fragmentation. On the left-hand side is the cooperation. On the right-hand side is the all these regions have to meet the standard on their own. And I think the most important takeaway here is you still meet the standard through coal to gas switching. That's your primary least cost option given our current expectations around prices. You actually get a little bit more in the regional fragmentation case. You now have 22 different standards, which means you have 22 different shifts in incentives region to region, and that does change the national generation outcome to some degree. And when you have a bigger coal to gas shift, you have greater emission reductions relative to a national program because of this fragmentation-driven gas shift. And then when you think about costs, you could see practically a factor of two impact in rates relative to a national cooperation case. This is, again, somewhat intuitive, but also very important. You know, the more states can cooperate, the lower rate impacts will be for consumers nationally. And that's an important thing to consider in this analysis. You do also see a domino effect into your expenditure story when rates go up like that. And then meanwhile, you're talking about potentially a difference of about $10 billion in costs between national cooperation and regional fragmentation. So now I'll turn it back to Trevor.
Great, thanks. So those shifts in generation that John outlined have significant impacts on other parts of the energy sector. Important to stress that this is our estimate of what the most cost-effective generation-side solution would be at currently projected natural gas prices and renewable energy costs. Those gas prices could be different, which would change those outcomes, and that's something we're exploring in the sensitivities for the October report. Gas prices could be different, renewables costs could be different. Also, it's entirely possible that states would develop state implementation plans that weren't the most cost-effective possible option. And it's possible that renewable or other technology-specific supports will be included in state implementation plans that leads to different generation outcomes. But if states implement what's currently seen as the most cost-effective approach, the upstream impacts are considerable. That shift from coal to natural gas generation has a potential to increase total U.S. gas consumption by up to 40% relative to what would have occurred without the Clean Power Plan between 2020 and 2030. Because of the shale boom, the vast majority of that increase in U.S. gas demand is met through an increase in U.S. natural gas production, mostly from shale, with a small change in our net natural gas trade position, a slight reduction in natural gas pipeline imports from Canada, and increase in natural gas imports from Canada. But 90% or so of that increase in consumption is met through domestic production. Similarly, a shift from coal to gas means a lot less coal consumption. And we see up to a 47% reduction in U.S. coal demand as a result of that shift in power generation under the Clean Power Plan. Most of that reduction in coal consumption is due to reduction in coal production. Coal miners in our modeling have some ability to mitigate that impact through higher exports, assuming current coal export capacity. Important to note in this analysis, we don't project changes in coal export capacity like the currently proposed coal terminals on the West Coast, which would have an impact on the outlook for U.S. coal producers resulting from this policy. Given current EIA projections for the shale gas resource base and cost in the U.S., that 14% increase in consumption, 11% increase in production, occurs with only a modest increase in domestic natural gas prices, so 9% on average between 2020 and 2030 at Henry Hub relative to what prices would be otherwise. So the EIA projects an increase in natural gas prices in the years ahead, and in the presence of the Clean Power Plan, those natural gas prices are about 9% higher at Henry Hub than they would be otherwise. Delivered natural gas prices rise by about 2.5% in that scenario relative to what would have occurred otherwise, and similarly a decline in delivered coal prices in the U.S. due to less demand. So you add an increase in natural gas production to a increase in natural gas prices, and you get a significant change in natural gas revenue, both to producers at the wellhead and total sales revenue that includes pipeline distribution. So up to a 20% increase in the amount of money U.S. natural gas producers make each year relative to what they would make absent that change in power sector demand for natural gas, and a up to $28 billion a year decline in coal sales revenue in the U.S. as there's less demand for coal from the Powder River Basin in Wyoming, the Illinois Basin in the Midwest, and from central Appalachia. The magnitude of those upstream impacts in dollar terms, that shift from natural gas production revenue to coal production revenue from an economic standpoint is actually much more significant than what's occurring downstream, than the changes in energy costs, as you can see with the slide on the right. So in the national without EE scenario, total nationwide energy expenditures increased by a little more than $3 billion a year on average, but you have an order of magnitude larger than that change in production revenue from coal to gas. So that's one of the more significant economic stories, we think, of potentially of the Clean Power Plan, and something that to date has not gotten much attention. Everybody's focused on what's going to happen to electricity prices in the electricity sector directly. And that change upstream has important impacts on the regional economics of the Clean Power Plan. And this is in previewing some findings that we're going to go into in much more depth in the full report in October. And as different parts of the country evaluate what this means for them, what kind of state plan should they develop, who's going to win, who's going to lose, what's the impact, it's important for states to think about the upstream effects as well as the downstream effects. So we do this analysis by census region. I know nobody thinks of themselves as living in a census region. I have to repeatedly check to see which census region I live in. But it is a level of aggregation that is kind of sufficient to derive useful insights about the impacts and what we present both today and in our October report. So take a look at the map, figure out which state you live in, and just remember your color, if you're green or yellow or orange, because I'll flow those colors through to the rest of the slides. As John said, EPA took a building blocks approach to developing the Clean Power Plan. What they did is they looked at abatement opportunities state by state using those building blocks. So how much emission reductions could occur in a particular state due to efficiency, due to increased deployment of natural gas combined cycles, due to renewables, due to coal efficiency improvements, and then they added that all up to create the emission rate target for that state. Because emission reduction opportunities vary by state, the compliance obligation under the Clean Power Plan varies by state as well. So the West-South Central Census Region, for example, which is Texas, Oklahoma, Arkansas, Louisiana, has a per capita abatement expectation that is more than twice as large as many parts of the Midwest and New England. That's already attracted some attention as people try to figure out what's the regional impact of this plan, how balanced is it by region. But an important complement to that story is looking at the regional variation, how the upstream impacts will be felt, not just the downstream compliance costs. So on this slide, we compare the change in production revenue from coal, which is above the below the line, versus natural gas, which is above the line, between 2020 and 2030, again relative to what's projected to occur without the Clean Power Plan in place. And we do that both with efficiency crediting and without efficiency crediting. And you see quite a bit of variation across regions. So that west-south-central region that has the largest compliance obligation also sees the largest benefits in terms of increased natural gas production, up to a $17, $18 billion a year increase in average natural gas production revenue relative to what would have occurred otherwise, offset slightly by a $1 billion a year decrease in coal production revenue. Right. Meanwhile, the mountain region sees a $7.5 billion a year decrease in coal production revenue, largely concentrated in my home state of Wyoming, which mines 40-50% of the country's coal, partially offset by an increase in natural gas production revenue, but not fully offset. Those dynamics are largely the same with efficiency crediting and without efficiency crediting, but the magnitude changes, right? Because crediting efficiency requires less fuel switching in the power sector to meet the target, the upstream impacts are less pronounced. And as with the national case, when you compare the magnitude of those upstream impacts to the magnitude of the downstream impacts, it highlights why it's important to think about this in the broader energy market context, right? So again, West South Central, which is a net increase of up to $17 billion a year in fossil fuel production revenue, sees an increase of $1.1 billion a year in energy expenditures. So if you're in the West South Central Census region, that's the more important economic story for you. That's going to have a bigger impact on the composition of the economy in your region than the changes in energy costs resulting from the CPP. Likewise, if you're in Wyoming, the rate impacts in Wyoming, you mostly use Bonneville hydropower. The rate impacts are probably going to be pretty modest. Your equities in this debate are all about coal production. It's not about the price of electricity in the state. And that's why it's important, we think, to take these dynamics into account, as well as, and I think Sarah's going to speak to this in a second, the importance of thinking about how we link this conversation about power sector policy to energy policy elsewhere, about pipeline infrastructure and other supply decisions.
So basically, that was an overview of where we are to date, right? And as Trevor just alluded to, we think that starting the conversation now, because people have options about how they engage this conversation, about what your options are, what the design implications or the implications of different design decisions are, is an important discussion to have in light of or in the context of these broader energy market impacts, not just the downstream, but certainly taking the upstream into consideration. So what we're going to do for the fall is extend the analysis to include additional scenarios. So as you can see, we'll do a regional fragmentation without energy efficiency, regional cooperation, additional regional cooperation options, and then looking at playing around this issue of energy efficiency and the cost effectiveness of those policies. It's as I've learned, I didn't know nearly as much about this when we started. That is quite a conversation. So we're going to unpack it in as hopefully an understandable way as possible. And then really, you know, some of the stuff that we have been spending a lot of time thinking about here at CSIS is there's a lot of things you can think about vis-a-vis the opportunities associated with the shale gas boom, as long as it's predicated on affordable, reliable supplies that can get produced and moved where they're needed. There's a lot in that sentence. And so what we're going to do is look at some of the scenarios based on the variation in gas prices, right, and the differential between gas and coal prices that might elicit. And then also some other big policy issues that we've been looking at, which is the potential range of options in terms of gas LNG exports or gas exports in, more generally, and what that might mean, those types of market sensitivities might mean for some of the broader energy market conclusions that we've been able to show today. And I think it's really important because, as Trevor said, it will help illuminate sort of on a regional basis where there may be other energy policy issues either dealing with production or dealing with infrastructure or dealing with, you know, power sector choices and decisions that will allow us to help people understand what their options are for sort of engaging in this discussion in perhaps a more robust way than the discussion has been to date. And so we'll be, hopefully that last sort of finding will help illustrate why the regional perspective on this is really quite important, not only for sort of informing the national discussion, but also in helping states and regions who are thinking about this in a real-time basis about what their options are and how they might want to think about those in terms of where they might want to pursue cooperation or what kind of policies they would want to put in place. So if I've not forgotten anything, I think that that's our sort of preliminary findings. Again, we've been talking about this with folks over the course of the last several days, and actually have already received some insights that are helping us to think about how we can incorporate either design features or certain sensitivities that'll help us be even more instructive to informing the debate that we're looking to be helpful to. And so we thank you guys for listening, and we would love to sort of have some feedback on some of your questions and a bit of a discussion. So there are microphones in the back. The only thing I would say is please just wait for a microphone because we are webcasting the event, and then state your name and affiliation, and you can either make a comment or, but we always like it when it sort of ends in a question that helps us know where to go from there. So, Kevin.
Thank you, Kevin Massey with Statoil. Thanks for a great presentation. This is one of the most sophisticated analyses I've seen of this issue. And of course, the energy efficiency issue is really where this seems to break down, especially in your analysis. I want to get into the legal defensibility of energy efficiency as a building block, because this is a technical, I guess, quantitative analysis. But I'm trying to understand the issue of emissions abatement and the value of energy efficiency of the energy efficiency pathway relative to the non-energy efficiency pathway that you guys laid out. Am I right in interpreting what you just presented as saying that if energy efficiency is included, the emissions abatement outcome will be lower than if it is not included? And I guess a follow-up question to that is, if energy efficiency is included in the state implementation plans, is there what happens post 2030? Because you get a I guess you go after the energy efficiency opportunities that exist to a certain point, but there's diminishing marginal returns on energy efficiency. So would the US be on a what kind of post 20 emissions pathway with the U.S. beyond if energy efficiency was included in state implementation plans relative to the alternative, which is without energy efficiency?
Yeah, so there's a lot in that set of questions. The first thing is I'll kind of restate one point, which was, you know, an emissions rate standard doesn't predetermine an emissions outcome. You know it's going to go down as you ratchet down the standard, but you don't know where you're going to end up because of things like prices for different fuels and technologies, level of electricity demand, and what types of policies you're using to get to that emissions rate goal. So there's a variety of things there. EE is material to what the actual emissions outcome is. Part of that is, you know, I think when people look at EE as a building block in setting up the standard, you know, it's considered kind of a one-for-one switch out between that and renewables. The next megawatt gets a proportional reduction in emissions. But what we see in the analysis is that the market impacts of that play out very differently. You know, it's all about what EE displaces in the market, and we see it largely displacing not baseload, but natural gas. So that's a lower emitting resource. And that has differences on the emissions rate, on the total emissions outcome. On your question about 2030 and beyond, first of all, we assume the standard stays flat after that because that's what the Clean Power Plan currently contemplates. As far as EE is concerned, we have cost escalators in our cost of EE that go up, so assuming you're kind of working your way up the supply curve of EE, and that's consistent with EPA's assumptions, but we don't think that EE, you run out of energy efficiency. The retail electric demand forecast when you include EE is essentially flat through 2030. You know, U.S. electric demand stays almost flat for that decade. So it starts to rise after that a little bit, but it doesn't rise nearly at the same rate as we see in the reference case forecast.
Let me see if I can, because it took me a long time to get my head around this, too, like hours of conversation with John, like explaining this to me. So let me see if I can dumb it down a little bit. So two things going on, we think. First is that creating a baseline against which you credit efficiency is hard, right? You have to project, like, what would efficiency improvements have been otherwise, and then you claim credit for your departure from that. And we think that there will likely be a modest amount of hot air in that analysis. that states will credit efficiency that would have occurred otherwise. So that's reason one.
And that's captured to some degree in our analysis.
Right. Now, if they guarantee that all of the efficiency is additional and they can successfully implement that, then you're not going to see as large of a difference as we show there. But we assume that some of that's going to occur. The second is that when EPA set the rate goals and identified how many credits you get for efficiency versus how many credits essentially you get for natural gas and others, the assumption was that every megawatt hour of demand reduced is going to proportionately back out natural gas, coal, everything else in the market. It turns out that efficiency improvements don't proportionally impact the power sector. They occur at different times of the day, which have disproportionate impacts on generation. And so what we're finding in this analysis is that the generation that gets displaced by efficiency is less coal heavy than the generation that gets displaced by supply side solutions. Does that make sense? The other kind of related point I would raise, I think the question is good on, we're looking at a 2020-2030 time horizon. We have to think about how this sets us up for the next phase. And I think the efficiency point is right. The other point that jumps out at me is, because of the shale boom, we have this really large quantum of abatement that we can grab through dispatch change, right? Going from coal to natural gas. That is a one-off, largely, right? Over the long term, we're going to, if we want to reduce emissions anything like, 80% by 2050, you either have to equip that natural gas with CCS, or you have to move to nuclear and renewables, right? So another question is, if under this policy, we comply just through coal gas switch, which is, in our modeling, the most economically efficient option in the next two decades, what does that do to the cost of emission reductions over the longer term? I think that's an important question, too.
Other questions? We answered them all. Yes, sir.
Could you just talk a little bit more about why you chose EE as the sort of variable to isolate first? Like, why is that something you identify as such a black and white differentiator?
There's a few reasons. I mean, one is EE is kind of novel in this proposal as far as a pollution reduction goal, in the sense that most EPA regulations consider just supply side options, and this one's a little different. So we thought that was an important distinction. Another is, if you look at climate policy in the states right now, most state explicit climate policies don't credit EE. You've got RGGI, which is a cap and trade program. You've got California, cap and trade program. And so they have energy efficiency programs. It's not that EE isn't valuable to their overall policy goals, but it is not directly linked with the carbon policy. So, when thinking about how states might implement the Clean Power Plan, we thought that was an interesting dichotomy, where, most state efforts to date have been a generation side effort in dealing with carbon specifically.
Yeah, and also just if you're thinking about the broader energy market impacts,
right,
the two variables we isolate, the extent to which efficiency is credit and the level of interstate cooperation, we think are the two most significant in terms of shaping what the ultimate energy market outcome would be. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
We've got, in the back right there, please, Bruce.
Hi, Bruce Phillips, and thank you for the presentation, and the study is just tremendously interesting. I'm sure it'll be useful to all sorts of folks. One question on the gas supply assumptions. Your results, I think, show a lot greater increase in the demand for natural gas in the United States than some of the results from EPA in the regulatory impact analysis. But the price increase at Henry Hub that you're forecasting, if I understand this right, is more or less sort of in the same ballpark as what EPA is suggesting. And so I guess there's some underlying differences in the gas supply assumptions in what EPA was using in its IPM modeling and what you're using in NEMS. And I'm wondering, did you rely strictly on the NEMS model for the underlying gas supply assumptions, or did you develop some of your own assumptions that you then folded into the NEMS modeling system?
We just use the NEMS assumptions, yeah. And then what we'll do is we'll bookend a high resource case and low resource case to test the sensitivity to that. I don't know IPM very well. I mean, my understanding is that just has a simplified gas supply curve that it feeds into the power market, whereas in NEMS, it's a kind of field-by-field cost-based production function. It's been a very difficult past decade in projecting shale production and prices in the U.S. Each year, I think we've been surprised on the upside in terms of production and on the downside in terms of price, but that could, of course, change at any point, right? We could start to be disappointed in terms of how much shale gas there is available and at what cost, and so that's why we'll test out that range to see how sensitive those results are.
Okay, we had a question here and then also one here, so right here.
Thank you. Thank you very much for the great presentation. My name is Kun Nishimura from TEPCO Washington. My question is, when you assess the level of fuel switching from coal to gas, what kind of mechanism do you assume to be implemented? And do you assume any kind of carbon pricing, even implicit or explicit kind of shadow pricing?
Yeah, I mean, we're essentially, because the implementation picture is so uncertain, you know, you've got 50 states all making different policy decisions, we decided to not go down that road at all and just simply say, let's meet the emissions rate goal in the most cost-effective way possible, which is a tradable performance standard. So any generator above the emissions rate goal has to buy credits from generators below the emissions rate goal. So that's the policy that we captured, and then obviously with our sensitivities, with our different scenarios, we have different frameworks for that. That does produce a credit price that effectively monetizes that shift in incentives for generators in the market. I wouldn't call it the same thing as a carbon price, but it has different impacts for both the incentives and for rate impacts and all sorts of things. It's not the same thing as a tax or a cap and trade program, but that effectively is how it works.
Okay. Adrian Henny, University of Zurich, Switzerland. Also, I want to really thank you for that. Really a great presentation of the proposal. My question is, carbon dioxide emissions are only one part if we talk about greenhouse gas emissions. Another important and, in fact, much more powerful greenhouse gas is methane. And with natural gas, we have in the cycle from the production of natural gas until it gets burned in the power plants, we have a lot of leaking and emission of methane into the atmosphere. And, I mean, roughly what we know now, if we have leakage of methane of more than 3.2% of the natural gas, then natural gas doesn't have any advantage towards coal when it comes to greenhouse gas emissions or climate warming footprint. And since the coal to gas switch would obviously, I mean, the additional gas, natural gas, would obviously come from shale gas, as conventional production is plateaued or declining since a long while in the U.S. Most of the studies that are out, including those of various U.S. government agencies, clearly show that the leakage of methane now is probably between 3% and 6% of the gas produced. So that would mean, with the status that we have now, there is no climate footprint advantage of natural gas over coal to expect. So a serious issue that would have to be addressed is to massively reduce the leakage of natural gas in the production cycle until it gets to the power plant. Is there anything provisioned in the EPA proposal to address this issue so that the switch from coal to gas would actually result in an advantage on the global warming front?
So let me do a kind of preliminary on that, and then I'm going to hand it over to John. We could spend the rest of the session on that question, obviously. I have the benefit of being able to punt on it because the EPA proposal does not require states to take into account methane leakage in determining its carbon performance standard from the power sector. Well, I guess it's a GHG standard, but it's just from the power sector directly. What we have in the analysis is a projection of
the increase, resulting increase in natural gas production. And so I encourage you to apply your own leakage estimate to that to come up with your conclusion of whether you think that's, you know, a net benefit or not. My general intuition is that at the EPA inventory leakage estimate rates, that would not materially change the picture relative to what we showed you today in terms of climate benefits. If you think that average leakage rates are higher or considerably higher than the EPA inventory estimates, then that of course would change the picture.
I would just add that not only does EPA not require states to consider, say, the life cycle emissions profile of natural gas or any of the abatement options, I don't believe the Clean Air Act requires EPA to consider the life cycle abatement emissions of the power sector standards. They're only looking at regulating CO2 from fossil fuel fired power plants, and that's the sole focus of the regulation. Right. I mean, that's another point,
yeah.
You know, which is, you know, that doesn't mean this one standard is the only thing EPA is doing on climate change. You know, there's currently multiple white papers out there, and they're starting the process of regulating methane from a variety of sources. I haven't followed that all that closely,
yeah.
But obviously, you know, that's another, I mean, you said we should be looking at that. Well, EPA is.
Yeah, one of the things that we're buying ourselves more time to sort of deal with is that there's a whole host of issues. I mean, we've sort of dug into the energy efficiency ones because it's a building block, right? But there's a whole host of policies and issues out there that would materially impact the effectiveness of a lot of these policies, right? So, for example, lots of states have renewable energy policies, and they may have a desire to implement stronger renewable energy policies that would materially change the outcome here based on their desire to have more renewable energy, right? So, and similarly, there's a whole, you know, robust discussion on trying to get your hands around the methane issue that is not included in this conversation, but is nonetheless one that you could see, if it was successful, is going to be having an impact sort of on the actual climate benefits or sort of, you know, abatement benefits of this policy over that time period. One of the things we're trying to figure out is to, in addition to sort of the infrastructure issues and all that kind of stuff, is how to sort of include that so that people understand, you know, where in parts of the countries those other policy issues are being emphasized and where at a national level they're being emphasized and how to think about those things. So it's a foundational question. It's an excellent question when you're getting at what the policy is actually trying to deal with. It's just not something that is taken into consideration within sort of the design elements. Yeah. So we had one right here with the blue tie. And then we've got another one in the back of the glasses.
Hi, Jordan Collins with Mintz Levin. I have a couple quick assumption questions. You looked at energy efficiency as an alternative a bit to more power generation. Did you take into account potential reductions in power generation from distributed generation or shifts in utility policy at like decoupling? That was one question. Additionally, on the renewable side, what are you thinking about the technology learning curves on utility scale storage? Because that could definitely change the dynamic on the levelized cost for renewables. And then kind of a simple question is, when you say national cooperation, what are the assumptions you're making on who is going to cooperate as the new REGI, or is REGI going to change? What are you thinking about who's gonna partner up or who's not? And then finally, if your final proposals are going to be out in fall, the folks who are submitting comments might not have the benefit of your results in time to submit comments to the EPA. So I was wondering if it's going to be before October 16th or not.
Probably won't stop.
I can start with some of these assumption questions. First off, we considered EES with DG and utility policies. We didn't change anything that's in the NEMS, you know, annual energy outlook based assumptions. DG generation does not count towards compliance here because of just the way the model structured. So it's only utility scale renewables that get credit. On storage, again, same thing. We used annual energy outlook base case assumptions, so we didn't change any assumptions around energy storage. On national cooperation, this is kind of the gold standard for cooperation, a single national standard. So everybody's playing with everybody in those scenarios. So that's important to keep in mind. In the final report, we actually do intend to explore qualitatively, you know, how would cooperation, how could cooperation really play out? You know, what types of states, what kind of circumstances facilitate cooperation with which states? Without making, you know, crystal ball assumptions about, you know, projections of who's going to do what, but just still exploring that discussion. And then in the fall, with regard to timing, yeah, we see the biggest value to this report, I think Sarah would agree, in informing implementation, not clean power design, not the clean power plan design. We'd love, I mean, one reason to get this out now is to get some of these bigger ideas out there into the discussion and in time for comments. Maybe EPA will extend the comment period and we'll be able to benefit from that. But we really think that, you know, in a lot of what we're learning is much more an implementation discussion than it is a design discussion.
Yeah, no, we're working as fast as we can.
Yeah.
It's a great point. More information earlier is always better.
It's October 15th.
How about
you? Write your comments.
But you know what's interesting is we've been thinking about it certainly from that perspective as well, right? I mean, I think that the timeline is a pretty fast one under anyone's approximation, and so that makes it a little bit difficult. But along what John was saying, you know, even though we are sort of taking this as a two-part process right now, you can actually see, you know, there will be a lot more process after, you know, the fall as well, which gets to when you think about implementation, when you think about sort of resolution of what you're ultimately going to end up doing, there's a huge amount of preparation that goes into even getting anywhere close to doing it, you know, in an economically efficient way. That's a long-term game at this point, right? I think at the outset you were saying, you know, we won't know what this looks like until 2018, 2019. We see this as the beginning of that conversation. And so, there'll be a lot of comments, and I hope this is one of the things that people start to take into consideration. But, you know, very humbly, and maybe you guys are more prepared for it than I, but I think we're still learning about the best way to express some of these, you know, broader energy sector impacts as well. And so we don't want to jump the gun on that, too, because we need to identify all the relevant questions on a regional basis. Okay. Right there.
Max Parnas, Toyota Motor North America. I had a question kind of about how you incorporate energy efficiency and renewables into the model. In the TSD for the document, for the rule, there's whole lists of how many megawatt hours of renewables are produced in each state and so on, and energy efficiency savings in each state. Do you put those into NEMS and then constrain it when it runs so that it matches the IPM results? Or do you just let it run and determine what that is? So I guess, are you trying to match up your renewables and energy efficiency to IPM results, or are you just letting NEMS run and seeing what comes out?
Yeah, go for it.
So I think this is really an important point. The building blocks are how EPA identified the target for each state. It is in no way an indication of how each state should comply. The IPM results do not model abatement in each state based on the building blocks. The IPM results model abatement based on whatever the most cost-effective way of meeting that emission rate target is, and that's the same here. So we take that abatement target that was identified by EPA by using the building blocks, and then we implement that in the model and generate the most cost-effective solution to reducing emissions CO2 rates to the target set by EPA. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Yes.
Correct. But I think it's important to note that if you look at the IPM results, the mix of abatement that takes place in each state is not going to be the same as the building blocks for
that
state.
Right. No, those are an outcome.
Correct.
Like,
that's right. Yeah.
Right.
So your renewable stuff is coming from NEMS.
That's right.
Yes.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Now EE is a little different, and that's important. So we are not trying to match the demand forecast in IPM in that case. We are saying, using the same presumption that EPA did in their RIA analysis, where we say, okay, 1.5% per year retail sales savings happen in each region all the way out through 2030, that gets you an energy savings amount that we then require the model to start with. So we say, okay, take that off of the top for retail demand, you know, retail sales demand of electricity, and then let the model go from there. So there's actually rebound in there, you know, energy costs less, and so there's a bit more demand for electricity that bounces back from that level. Then there's the rest of the tradable performance standard on top of that, trying to meet the overall goal. So there, EE is a little more complicated, but it's still not matching IPM by any means. Okay.
Yes, sir.
James Tsang. In this pretty picture, where do technological uncertainties such as whether CCUS will work show up?
I mean, just very quick, CCS is in is a technology option in the model. And in fact, we see a very small amount of CCS start to come in near the end of the forecast under our national without EE scenario. And that's mostly natural gas of CCS. It plays such a small role in this time frame that it's probably not a technology cost sensitivity that's we think would be all that valuable. A different technology cost is something that folks have asked about is the cost and performance assumptions around renewables and whether or not that's something we should explore, and that's something we're contemplating. I'd also say that CCS retrofits of coal plants is a compliance option in the model, and we don't see it happen.
Any other questions? Oh, one more. We have two more now. The woman just on the end there, Fiona. Thanks.
Susan Blevins, ExxonMobil. Going back to the discussion on the carbon price, can you speak to how the prices that the model did calculate compares to EPA's cost per building block?
No. Okay. We can't. Sorry. No, it's not a comparable. It's not a abatement per ton value. It's a credit price to meet the policy constraint, which is a different number, and it's more about how much additional value is the next megawatt hour of low carbon generation to meet the emission standard, which is a very different calculation. The short answer is we don't really have a comparable output.
I mean, I guess you could do compliance cost over emissions.
Yeah,
I mean, per ton compliance cost. I don't know if that's what EPA used in their RIA, but
I think it's a question of comparability. And so one of the other things that it's not an answer to your question, but one of the things that we've been considering is the way in which we can actually derive some of those comparisons based on what we've done and what EPA has done. I mean, it is sort of different. And so we didn't do it for these purposes. It's possible to do, and your question helps us to know that it's useful to do. Yeah, thanks. Joe.
All right, we could do just. I had a question about the suite of energy efficiency measures that are considered in the energy efficiency scenario. And specifically, is CHP part of that scenario, or is it considered otherwise, or is it, as you were responding to the distributed generation question, CHP is not addressed?
Yeah, I mean, the CHP doesn't qualify because it's on the distributed generation side. And actually, just as far as how we did efficiency generally, we actually were agnostic as to what measures happen. We just say this amount of energy gets saved. So we didn't make any presumptions.
And use the cost. I mean, it's basically the EPA's estimate of the cost of efficiency versus EPA's with EPA's estimate of how much energy savings occurs. So it's the whatever the technology costs that are built into those assumptions.
Yeah.
Additional, Christy. Up here, Fran. Sorry. Right here. Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, go ahead.
Christy Tizak from Clearview. When you guys are going to look at the power market details, are you going to do it on RTOs, or how are you going to take a look at that? Because from a power perspective, as you know, census regions are pretty irrelevant, although they are darn helpful when you're marketing on the Hill. But, you know, beyond, you know, so there's a, you know, we've talked about the example of, you know, Reggie and the Northeast states. Well, Northeast states trading with each other is all well and good. But if you're looking to monetize your tradable performance standard, then wouldn't you love to get in bed with your cousins from another part of, you know, another part [S2] Right. [S1] Of the interconnect? So when you're looking at power markets, are you going to keep it at the RTO level for simplicity's sake, given the fact you have 10 minutes to finish this? Or are you going to look at maybe perhaps even interconnect-wide?
As far as results, which is, I think, where we were talking about providing detail, the 22 power market regions we showed you earlier on are probably the most granular we'll get as far as kind of what we might show. And that largely follows RTO boundaries, not perfect. But you know, you can get some of that, and then and you can certainly get interconnect wide numbers that way. That's relatively easy. As far as any policy inputs, as far as how trading might happen more aggregate than those 22 regions, that's something we're contemplating, but is not the easiest thing to complete both within the NEM structure we're working with, and just, you know, you get into this fraught area of who should work with who, right, in your analysis, and that's not, I mean, we can certainly contemplate some reasonable assumption there, but it's a trickier space.
But I think it's an area where I think we feel like this framework has limited utility in providing good insights about kind of RTO-specific mm-hmm. intertrading decisions. That said, I think the kind of national framework and upstream elements of this analysis can provide useful input to that. So it would be a great conversation to have for folks who are really looking at those, you know, in the weeds design questions about the costs and benefits of different interstate trading mechanisms. What type of insights from this analysis would be useful to inform that yeah. much more granular assessment?
All right, well, if there are no other questions, I just want to say, you know, I know Trevor had sort of mentioned at the beginning, but we get to be the pretty faces today. Certainly a big thank to Whitney and Shashank, and on the CSI side, Michelle Melton as well, for all the work they've put in thus far and will over the next few months. I hope our short, snappy 40-slide presentation will entice you enough to read the much longer version that will come out this fall with all of the sort of regional and sensitivity analysis. So thank you very much for coming, and thank you guys for working with us.
Thank you. Thanks very much.
Thanks.